penalty.
Oh, yeah.
Because nothing will save the Governor General.
When I say run, run.
Leo Barry, you star.
Woo. Any boss who sacks anyone for not turning up the day is a bum.
You tell him, ferret face.
Oh, talk about a he-man.
What?
Yes, we can.
What?
I am your father.
What?
No, whatever you want.
Woo!
You cannot be serious!
What?
Okay. The issue is not closed.
Woo! What?
Your time is up.
Hello everyone, welcome to edition 16 of the Phil's World Podcast. News galore, and we will start as usual with the footy. First off, massive congratulations are in order for Brent Harvey. It's big enough to play 400 games. Only four men have done it: Harvey, Dustin Fletcher, Kevin Bartlett and Michael Tuck. But it's even bigger to break the record for the most number of games played, which is what Boomer did last weekend, playing his 427th game to beat Tuck's record of 426. That has stood for 15 years, whereas previously the record fell a few times. KB held it before Tuck. In fact, I was there at the MCG in 1983 when he played his 400th game against Collingwood, the first of four men to do it. Going back into history, even breaking 300 was seen as massive, and only three men did it in the first 60-odd years of the VFL. Collingwood's Gordon Coventry, who played 306 games. Richmond's Jack Dyer, who played 312. And Essendon's Dick Reynolds, who played 320. Ted Whitten topped Reynolds in 1970 by one game, and then Kevin Murray topped that in 1974 with 333 after a battle through the year with John Nicholls, who did hold the record during that season. They both had 328 after round 17 that year, but Nicholls never played after that while Murray finished the year. John Rantell broke that in 1980 by three games, but Bartlett topped it when he played Richmond's first final that year. There are now a lot of players who have played 300 games, including another eight current players. Harvey makes nine, with the closest being Matthew Pavlich on 350. I doubt he will be playing next year, let alone in 2019, to even make it to 400. And you know what? I think Boomer has at least another season in him. I did like it when Lindsay Thomas gave him that dish off for the easy goal, especially after he hit the post in an earlier opportunity. And it was a hard-fought win the Kangaroos had over St Kilda. On that, let's go to the ladder reviews. And that win restored the big gap between 8th and 9th that looked like being closed a couple of weeks ago. And with four rounds to go and the continuing battle for spots in the top 8, that is just about locked. Hawthorn are now two games clear on top of the ladder, but they aren't safe in the top 4 yet, as there are four teams in that bunch two games back: West Sydney, Sydney, Geelong and Adelaide. The other three are going behind: West Coast, the Bulldogs and North Melbourne. The gap between 8th and 9th can come back to 2 if St Kilda beat Carlton. Because North and the Bulldogs are playing each other. I can't see Port Adelaide knocking off Sydney. But then St Kilda run into the Swans, even though, the Kangaroos play Hawthorn, North are the team that are the most vulnerable, and they could lose all four of their remaining games. But because of percentage, St Kilda have to win all four. They can win three, but they would need to be thumpings to make up the percentage difference. Port Adelaide won't win three, as they have Adelaide in a showdown, as well as Sydney. I think if North beat the Bulldogs, given that the Bulldogs have a couple of easy games against Essendon and Fremantle in the last two rounds, that will lock the final eight once and for all. Essendon are in the basement, as many predicted pre-season, and may well stay there. They have one game where they could eke out a win against Gold Coast, but percentage may be their enemy in getting past Brisbane. Well, let's see what the next month brings up. In the VFL, there are also four rounds to go. Williamstown are on top, a game clear of Casey and Collingwood, with Port Melbourne a further game back in fourth. Sandringham and Footscray are a game behind them, with Geelong and another game back, and Essendon a game behind them to round out the eight. But there's only two games separating the Bombers and the team in 13th place, so there's a lot that can happen there. The only two teams that are definitely out of the running are Frankston and North Ballarat, who are on the same points in the basement. Plenty of interest over the next 4 weeks, which would take too long to detail. In the SANFL, there are four rounds to go as well, and the top three teams seem to be almost settled, with Woodville, Torrens and Sturt on top, with the Eagles ahead on percentage, and South Adelaide again behind them. There's a two-game gap between the two-game gap to the Adelaide Reserves in fourth spot, and Centrals finish off the five a game back. There's also a two-game gap between Centrals and Port Adelaide Reserves in sixth, and they share the two-gap deficit with Glenelg. Again, I don't have time to detail it all, but with many buys coming up, it could well stay that way. West Adelaide remain in the wooden spoon position, two games adrift. In the Waffle, four rounds to go there also, and Subiaco are back on top since the last podcast, and they have put a two-game break on South Fremantle and West Perth on the same points, and there's another two-game gap down to East Perth and Peel in the five. Now, Peel in particular are under threat from East Fremantle in sixth place, a game back but with a better percentage. However, the Sharks are the only real threat to the Thunder, and indeed the Royals, as the rest are too far back. Swan Districts remain on the bottom with just two wins and three games behind Claremont, so I can't see them getting out of there. Down in Tasmania, there are three rounds to go, and the top three is locked. Glenorchy are on top, a game clear of North Launceston and Burnie, but then there's a 3.5 game gap to Lauderdale. Devonport are 1.5 games behind them, but they are two games clear of Clarence in the five, so it is unlikely that the top five as a whole will change. The top three can shift around, of course, but they are all guaranteed to finals. Kingborough are bringing up the rear, two games behind Launceston, and like Swan Districts, I can't see them climbing out of that spot. In the NEAFL, it's three rounds to go, and the Sydney Reserves are on top, two games clear of Aspley, and then it gets a bit close, with Sydney Uni a game behind them, and West Sydney and the Northern Territory are going behind them. Southport are two games back in sixth to round out the six, but they are under threat from Redland in seventh, even with the bad percentage there, as they are only a game outside the finals. I don't think the Swans will drop from the top, and I think the rest are safe. They will shuffle around, though. Redland, though, do have the bye this week, which may protect Southport, even though they are facing Sydney Uni in Sydney this weekend. If the Sharks can cause an upset there, the six will be locked. Down in the bottom tier, it's very close between Canberra and the Brisbane Reserves for the Spoon, especially after the Demons caused a monumental upset last weekend, knocking off the Thunder by 7 points in Canberra. In Sydney, there are three rounds remaining as well, and the top two are as good as confirmed, with East Coast three games clear on top, and will get the week off first up. St George are second and two games up on the third team, but there is a battle for that last spot in the top three, with North Shore, Pennant Hills and UTS all on 32 points. Manly are two games back in sixth, so I don't think they can make it. So the battle is on for third spot and a date with St George in the qualifying final. At the bottom of the ladder, New South Wales Uni East Sydney are just a game up on the Sydney Uni Reserves and Western Suburbs, so that's far from over as well. In the QAFL, it's also three rounds to go, and oh boy, here's a battle. Now, Palm Beach Currumbin are two games clear on top and should get the week off, but there's only a game separating second and sixth. Labrador, Western Magpies and Morningside are all on the same points, with Mount Gravatt half a game behind in fifth place, and then half a game behind them in sixth is Surface Paradise. Wow, plenty can happen there. And after what apparently happened last season to Surface, I never did follow up on that, they will be keen as mustard to snare a final spot. At the other end of the ladder, it's a battle between Sandgate and University for the Spoon. In Canberra, There are three rounds to go, including a split round and a catch-up game. But Ainsley are locked in on top three games clear. But their second semi-final opponents are far from settled, with Queanbeyan and Balconnen battling for that honour on the same points. The loser of that battle will definitely play in the first semi-final, but Tuggeranong are only a game inside the four ahead of Eastlake. However, the Hawks have bottom side Gungahlin this weekend, while the Demons face the top three teams in their run home. So I think the four may be locked there. Okay, to my favourite clubs, and Donvale will definitely be playing finals this year. We are safely tucked in third spot at the moment, a game behind Forest Hill with two rounds to go, and we should deal with Eastern Lions this Saturday. Now, we are a remote chance of stealing second spot in the final round, provided we give the Lions a good toweling up and Coldstream give the Zebras a fright this weekend. But it depends on us and on Glen Waverley, who are playing Forest Hill in the last round. Now, unless Glen Waverley defeat Surrey Park this weekend, they have to beat Forest Hill to make the finals. But we've got an uphill battle in the final round against the undefeated Ferntree Gully. However, who knows? They could be vulnerable, as a loss won't harm their ladder position and they could save themselves for the second semi. I might even go, but I haven't decided yet. There are other options, and I want to save myself for the grand final of Division 4 if we make it. Finishing second will help in that regard, but it also depends on where the Division 4 finals are being played, and I hate Boronia and East Burwood as venues for grand finals. Mitcham or Ringwood, on the other hand, would be great, and the EFL is after Mitcham for Division 4. It just needs to be confirmed. For Preston, there are three rounds to go, and the Bull Ants are even more secure in the four than the Vales, as we are four games clear of fifth spot. We can get to the top two, as we are only playing one team in the four in the run to the finals, and that's Yarra Valley, who are presently fourth. Topside St John's and second-placed West Brunswick are playing each other in the run home, and a St John's win would put second spot up for grabs. Now, West Brunswick play Melbourne High School in the last round, and MHS are the team in fifth spot at the moment, and they play Yarra Valley as well, as if they win that, they may play... They may well be in the four and need to win to retain their spot. So the Bull Ants could pick up the pieces and rise to second and play St John's in the second semi-final. It's going to be very interesting, and we have beaten them before. That one loss St John's have had this season was to the Bull Ants. Like Donvale, I may attend the VAFA Division 2 decider if Preston get there, but that also depends on the venue. And unlike the EFL, there are no indications of that as of yet. I think that grand final will be played on September the 10th. With my hated clubs, Heidelberg are locked in the top two in the top division in the Northern Football League, but even though they are on top at the moment, they play second place Greensboro this weekend, and a win there will make it a game the difference, and Heidelberg play two other finals contenders in the run to the finals. Just drop one and the Borough can take top spot and the week off. They have an easier run home playing the bottom two teams. Fingers crossed. North Heidelberg have charged down Hurstbridge at the top of Division 2, and they are on the same points, but only a game clear of third and fourth with three rounds to play. North, though, are playing both of the other finals contenders, while the Bridge are only playing one, so hopefully that will cause them to drop to the first semi-final come finals time, and they go straight out. We'll see what happens. That final series looks close, I have to say. The other two teams are Diamond Creek and Fitzroy Stars. Out Essendon way, there are also three rounds to go, and delightfully, Keilor have dropped off the top of the ladder, despite their belting of fellow hated team Airport West this past weekend. They are a game behind Aberfeldy, but they are three games ahead of the next group, headed up by Duda Stars, who have jumped into calculations there. However, this apparent drop in form, despite the Airport West win, means that they could be vulnerable. Duda has them this week, followed by Maribyrnong Park, who are a game behind that group, fighting for the two spots in the four. They have Aberfeldy in the last round in what is certain to be a second semi-final preview. And wouldn't it be nice if Keilor don't win again this season? Fingers crossed. I mentioned Airport West, of course. No win still, and their only chance is the last round against ninth-placed Avondale Heights, who have been sending some shudders through the other clubs. Heck, they made Pasco Vale work this past weekend to get that 19-point win. So Airport West are definitely heading for the lower division in 2017. Elsewhere, we have two premierships that have already been decided, both in Western Australia this past weekend. In the East Kimberley competition, Warren Garry conquered Ord River for their first flag since 2013. And over in the Fortescue League, Saints defeated Towns for their second flag in a row. No grand finals this weekend, but next weekend we have the Newman League decider, and then the grand final numbers build as leagues start their finals. The business end of the season, and I start my ladder collection for this season as well. In other news, coming out of Adelaide, the South Australian Amateurs have kicked Rosewater out of the competition after what has been put over as a particularly violent clash against Blackfriars. It's unfortunate that such action was needed, but when a club captain and a 300-game veteran attacks an umpire, leaving him with a bruise and cut eye, and rightly cops a 20-year suspension for it, on the back of a history of violence and threats towards umpires, the league had no choice, really. The club president did apologise to the umpires panel just before training the next week, and he has vowed that Rosewater will be back in 2017. But I think it's going to take an effort to fix things up, because the club is going to need a clean out and a big one. They have the room to be shifted down two divisions from 5 to 7 to cover for that. The club's juniors are, of course, unaffected. And with the project, I finally got the update finished, and I made two visits to the State Library of Victoria this past month, as well as one to the State Library of Tasmania. It's been a fun year with my Tasmanian trips. And I want to thank the TFUA for helping me out with transport to Richmond and to Pontville for the Brighton game. I hope to continue that relationship in 2017, but that entirely depends on my finances. And I also need to make room for Launceston, as I meant to visit them this year, but I couldn't get any communication from the umpires group there. Adelaide has also been good for the record. I'm planning September and the grand finals I'll be attending, and hopefully I can draw ever closer to my aim of seeing every active league's grand final. Seeing Donvale and Preston might get in the way of that, of course. It won't be easy with all the travel required to achieve that, especially interstate, as I've never been to a grand final in Queensland, Western Australia, Tasmania, or the Northern Territory. I'm hoping that will change this year, but all except Tasmania are not cheap, especially the Territory, as I only have Alice Springs, Tennant Creek, and Katherine as options there. And that's it for the footy. Okay, let's get into the wrestling. First off in WWE, the brand split is now up and running. And you know what? It's fantastic that WWE has given Daniel Bryan a job as GM of SmackDown alongside Shane McMahon, while Mick Foley is the Raw GM alongside Stephanie. We had some elevations as expected, but surprisingly, no Bayley. And no Samoa Joe or Asuka. Finn Balor went early, and so did American Alpha. But with the girls, we had Nia Jax, Alexa Bliss, and Carmella elevated. Carmella will be on the SmackDown. Will be on SmackDown while her buddies Enzo and Cass are on Raw, which is a shame. But what the heck is Eva Marie doing on the main roster? That's a joke. Heath Slater wasn't drafted, which is a bad sign for him, although they did a spot with him on SmackDown where he was gored by Rhino, and then the next week on Raw, screwed by the returning Jinder Mahal. And unless her injury status protects her, Emma might also be in trouble. Fingers crossed there. Interestingly, Brock Lesnar was drafted, but The Undertaker was nowhere to be seen. Interesting. But a battleground. I was delighted when Bayley was announced as Sasha Banks' tag team partner, as predicted by yours truly on Twitter. And so was the crowd who was there. She did well in her main pay-per-view debut, and the win I thought would give Sasha her title shot at SummerSlam, but it was instead given on Raw the next night, and we have a new women's champion. Good for Sasha, and I love that spot that led to Dana Brooke being kicked out, right out of Eddie Guerrero's playbook. Viva La Raza! But the match of the night at Battleground, without a doubt, was Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens. I wanted them to get 20 minutes. They went for 18, which was fine. And it was fantastic, complete with the perfect finish and those two Huluva kicks from Sammy. It was a good show all up with plenty of interest in the main event, and Dean Ambrose retained, and the SmackDown roster came out as one to celebrate. And I wasn't surprised Stephanie called Roman Reigns a loser just because he was the one that was pinned.
You're despicable.
Now, I would have thought that with SummerSlam coming up, they would go after Ambrose's title on Raw, but instead they bailed to creating their own top-level title, the WWE Universal title. But in the good news, the final match for the first champion will be between Seth Rollins and Finn Balor. That's fantastic for Finn, and I love that match on paper. And over on SmackDown, they put Dolph Ziggler into the number one contender's position, making for a fresh double main event for SummerSlam. It is a new era, and I hope it attracts fans back to WWE. Both matches look great on paper, and the first promos this past week were good, appropriate, and most importantly, different. We also have a rematch between AJ Styles and John Cena, the rematch between Sasha Banks and Charlotte, and the match that is driving a big wedge between Raw and SmackDown, Brock Lesnar and Randy Orton. With NXT, the main event for TakeOver Brooklyn has been signed, with Samoa Joe defending the NXT title against Shinsuke Nakamura. We also have the rematch between Asuka and Bayley, and I'm expecting Austin Aries against No Way Jose as well. But I'm not happy at the moment, because Fox 8 at the end of July pulled Main Event, NXT and Superstars from TV here. Main Event was already on its last legs because it was only being produced for international markets after Sky Sports in the UK forced it off the WWE network. And Superstars wasn't really important. But NXT disappearing from our TV screens is not good news. And the only way you can see it now is on the WWE Network. And as I mentioned on the last podcast, I'm not a fan of it because of the buffering issues in Australia, making it not worth the $9.99 US dollars. And it's worse because with the brand split, they are bringing back extra pay-per-views. And I believe the Main Event channel is not picking the extras up. So I'm going to have to figure something out before SmackDown's first offering, the return of Backlash in early September. And briefly over in TNA, Bobby Lashley now has both the heavyweight title and the X Division title in a plot device that I haven't looked into yet. They've done that before, but I have no idea if this one makes sense or not. There have been no other title changes since Slammiversary. Now, one more tidbit, and it comes from the following quote. Just a second. Just had to fix something up there. And it comes from the following quote from a forum that I won't name. Quote, "He sounds like a bit of a weirdo. I grew out of pretending to be a wrestler when I was really young." Unquote. Now, I would like to challenge Jono to say that to the likes of Ric Flair, Triple H, Steve Austin, John Cena, and even George Julio. He would get lynched. Listen, Jono, I will be the first to admit, pro wrestling is an acquired taste. But that quote shows that you are ignorant of the nature of pro wrestling, in particular, the level of athleticism that is required to carry off the stuff they do. I'm not a wrestler and never have been, notwithstanding the three matches I've been in. But as a referee, I have been in the ring and witnessed firsthand some fantastic moves, like a man leaping off a chair to kick an opponent sitting on the top rope, only to be cut down in midair by a spear from the guy on the ropes. Thank you, Jerry Craven and Rhino here. And that's just one example. Yes, the results are predetermined, although sometimes things do go wrong and the result is changed on the spot, as I have done as a referee. But the physicality is real. When you hit the mat, it hurts if you don't hit it right, and even if you do, you have to be prepared for the pain and get used to it, especially if you are in a ring that isn't that good. AJ Styles, for instance, on the Stone Cold podcast, reflected on the difference between the six-sided ring and the regular four-sided ring. He took a top rope superplex from Kurt Angle in the six-sided ring, and it hurt like hell, AJ's words. He then took the same move from the same wrestler in the four-sided ring, and to quote AJ, it was like a dream. Bottom line, Jono, don't call it something for the kids. That's disrespectful and ignorant. And that's all for the wrestling. Okay, let's get into the politics. And again, what a busy month we've had. The Australian Electoral Commission have been very busy putting the final touches on the new parliament. In the House of Representatives, the coalition somehow squeezed out 76 seats to keep power by the skin of their teeth. As of last night, when I last checked, 145 of the 150 seats have been declared officially. The five remaining are Grindler, Indi, Boothby, Port Adelaide and Kingston. But they are locked in anyway. Indi, of course, is Cathy McGowan's seat. The Liberals have retained Boothby and the others are all ALP. In the Senate, now, I have to correct the numbers here because I said a total of 230 seats in the combined sitting. In fact, it's 226 because the ACT and the Northern Territory only have two seats each and not four, and they are the only seats that are all that always go up for election, even in a normal half-Senate election. 76 seats in the Senate, not 80. Now, that error corrected. To my annoyance, Pauline Hanson has company in her party from Western Australia and maybe Tasmania. I'm not going to name them. And also, South Australia allowed a Family First member in, despite the three Xenophon members going in as well. That's Bob Day coming back to the Senate. Now, as of last night, we are still waiting for New South Wales and Queensland, but the numbers at present, including the provisional whole quota numbers for the remaining states, are the Coalition 28, ALP 25, Greens 7, Xenophon 3, One Nation 2, and one each for Family First, Hinch and Lambie. We still have eight to come from the two remaining states combined. Parliament returns on August 30, and it will be inevitable that there will be a combined sitting. To further that error correction that I made, the Coalition needs 114 votes to get their legislation approved, not 116. They have 76 from the House of Representatives guaranteed and 28 guaranteed from the Senate for a total of 104. They need another 10, and they won't get all 8 of the remaining seats, so they need the crossbenchers. I suspect Katter will support them, and I understand Family First will as well, Bob Day, but they need more. I've got my fingers crossed, especially with the ABCC, which, as I have said before, in its present form, is totally unacceptable. In the US, we've now had both conventions, and there were plenty of protests outside and inside the building for the Republicans. Despite all that, Trump got the nomination and got a bounce in the polls from it, much to my annoyance. But in a much quieter effort with no protests, Hillary Clinton nailed the Democrat nomination and promptly got a bounce in the polls as well to retake the lead. But as usual, and it will take too long to go through them, Trump has been opening his big yap and talking before putting that apology of a brain of his into gear. You know, I hope that the debates don't clash with the wrestling or anything else because I want to see them and hope like heck that Hillary slaughters him on every point. What will interest me about the debates more than anything else is whether or not Trump will get his way over who is asking the questions. He'll chuck a tantrum if Megyn Kelly is involved, I'll bet. Oh boy. Now, after I had a crack at David Cameron on the last podcast over his conveniently timed resignation announcement, I think the unsecure environment pushed all the right buttons and the matter was sorted out a lot quicker as it needed to be. And the UK has its second female Prime Minister in history in Theresa May. I like this move. Theresa was the minister who shut down America's attempt to extradite Gary McKinnon for his hacking efforts, which was the right thing to do. It did, of course, cause a reshuffle of the British cabinet, and the biggest moves were Philip Hammond from Foreign Affairs to Chancellor of the Exchequer, that's their name for the Treasurer, and Hammond being replaced as the Foreign Minister by Boris Johnson, who had to very quickly apply the brakes on some past remarks about some foreign leaders, especially one about Barack Obama, as Johnson was pro-Brexit and Obama was recommending against it, when he had a crack at Barack's Kenyan ancestry. That was rude. He was compared to Trump, but he's had the sense to distance himself from that idiot. On the personal front, there's been nothing new on housing or the death threats, and I'll get onto vaccine shortly. But once the writs are returned, which is Monday next week, I believe, I will be revisiting those last two issues. And I have tactics in mind, and I know that Catherine King will be on my side on the vaccines issue. She has retained her shadow portfolio in health, I did start another battle this past month, and I don't really need to do anything else at this point because work is already preparing to start on Skyrail between Caulfield and Oakley. I've detailed this on my political blog, so pop over there and have a look if you're interested. I hope to go further on housing this month as well, but as my local state member is busy with committee work, he's a chairman of one committee in particular, it's been hard to get an appointment with him. That's okay, I fully understand. That's what a good local member does. And that's it for politics. All right, let's get on to the other stuff. And first of all, I have an update on Kelly. That's the lady from South Africa who complained about me naming her on the AV name check on the All About Anti-Vaxxers blog. I was right, she was bluffing. She backed down and tried to negotiate a debate on the issues. Now, just like governments don't negotiate with terrorists, I don't negotiate with anti-vaxxers. Now, before anyone goes overboard, I am not saying that anti-vaxxers are terrorists. They're not. But why should I negotiate with a person who supports not protecting children from preventable disease? That's a no-brainer. Literally. All anti-vaxxers deserve is contempt. Utter contempt. And her name stays on the list, as I told her on the blog. Now, I will say that Kelly is not the maniac that Angela Coral Offer is. Sheesh! She laughed at my adding her name to the list, thinking that any publicity is good publicity. Well, she went silent when I found out that the name I had down for, had her down for, Angela Eisenhower, was her maiden name. I changed it to her married name, and I think she might have got the idea. I love the meme I put on the All About Anti-Vaxxers blog using her public domain picture and calling the smirk on her face the smirk of a jackal.
Emma, you stinker.
You are crazy, lady, and I'm not the only one who believes that either. Now, I am loath to mention Disinformer yet again, but after his crack at the last podcast, honestly, I've got no choice. Now, here are the lowlights. One. Kelly, who I naturally just spoke of, mentioned libel, you idiot. It was right there. You saw the bloody entry. You linked it after all. There was no libel, and I knew it. Putting a person's name and location somewhere isn't libel. If anything, it's a privacy issue, and that didn't exist because her location was right there on Facebook. Not the exact address, that would be illegal. Now, on the same point, Disson also claimed that I wasn't a gentleman. Well, you know what? When I am dealing with anti-vaccine maniacs, all thoughts of being nice and diplomatic in any way, shape or form are out the window. Why? Why? Because all of the bastards and bitches I named on the AV name check are insiders of child neglect slash abuse, if not actual child neglectors slash abusers. There was perfect proof on how nasty these idiots are, but I was unable to find it again before this podcast. But all you have to do is look up Francisco Vasquez. You'll get the idea. Two, Camby's definition of idiot is wrong. I'll even spell it out for you. W-R-O-N-G. Wrong! Honestly, no one runs with that definition anymore. And to do so is just plain stupid. So no, I won't use the definition in order to understand Camby because he is right out of touch with the real world. And that is why he has nothing to be afraid of. Zero, nada, zilch. Three, life choice? Look where that life choice is taking him. On a one-way trip to the funny farm. Not to mention a threat to the community that he lives in. So no, that cannot and should not be respected. Should we respect Blair Cottrell or Denny Nalia? Should we respect Adolf Hitler? Need I say more? There are aspects of diversity where a line exists that cannot be crossed. Camby crosses that line. Four, again with the lying under oath rubbish. Hey, listen, dummy. I had bloody backup. The written word from Camby, with the meaning plain as the nose on my face. How is that lying under oath? Here is the fact of the matter, Disson. Camby lied about me. His words harmed my reputation, in particular as a junior football umpire with multiple grand finals, as a political activist, and so on. 5. Now, me being afraid of Canby has some validity. He stated on his blog that he was coming out here to kill me. Look for yourself. Did I do that to him? Nope. Does he have my home address? Yes. Yeah, I have his as well, but do I have a passport? No. Does he have a passport? Yes. Do I have the financial means to make the trip to LA? No. Does he? Yes, through his father. And finally, he shows off about a gun. He is clearly willing to use one. Am I? Absolutely not. And I couldn't even if I wanted to, because my arms aren't strong enough to control the recoil. I know that from trying out my father's air rifle a long, long time ago. Fact, until Canby withdraws all his threats, apologises for them, and states that he is not coming to Australia, I have every reason to fear him. He is crazy, as I have already mentioned, and he should be locked up. 6, and last. Inconfidence applies across several streams, moron. Political, criminal, civil, you name it. It doesn't need to be top secret or even just secret. Confidential is the appropriate level. For example, in Parliament, if a document is labelled confidential, it can't be tabled. Same concept here. Just because Brandis has remained Attorney General doesn't mean that that angle is closed. There are plenty of ways to go, and all I have to do is make the appropriate adjustments. And after all that...
Why, you stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder!
And I'm not even going to bother with his commentary about my tribute to Muhammad Ali. Now, there's another thing that I want to talk about on this podcast, and gee whiz, I'm going to be running short here again, and that is trolling. Now, my commentary here was caused by this latent piece of hypocrisy from someone who I won't name. Quote, a real team beats Collingwood. A true fan of your team doesn't troll NMFC official 24/7. Unquote. I'm calling that out as hypocritical because that was trolling at its most scintillating. Now, the actual definition of troll, according to dictionary.com, has several recognised meanings. 1. To sing or utter in a full rolling voice. 2. To sing in a manner of a round or catch. 3. To fish for or in with a moving line, working the line up and down with a rod, as in fishing for pike or trailing the line behind a slow moving boat. 4. To move the line or bait in doing this. 5. To cause to turn around and round or roll. 6. To hand round as a bowl of liquor at table. That meaning is now regarded as obsolete. Now, this last one, which comes in two parts, is the meaning that is relevant here. 7. Digital technology informal. A. To post inflammatory or inappropriate messages or comments on the internet, especially a message board, for the purpose of upsetting other users and provoking a response. 2. B. To upset or provoke other users by posting such messages or comments. Now, the quote I gave just before was inflammatory and inappropriate and designed to upset and provoke others. Now, when someone hates someone or something with a passion, that happens. One could argue that I'm trolling the football clubs I hate earlier in this podcast and on other podcasts, and that I'm also trolling anti-vaxxers. Now, I put my hand up for that, because as far as I'm concerned, they are fair game and deserve it. Heck, in football, trolling happens all the time. There used to be only one way to troll football fans, and that was face-to-face making fun of them after they lose. Now, who did that this past weekend? Plenty of people. I'm sure this past weekend, Somerville fans and Hastings fans were trolling each other, and so on at the Phil's weekend game. But the thing is, it's not hate in the sense of being anti-Semitic towards Jews, as an example. That's hate speech. John Best's pro-Rothschild family BS is hate, and he has hate pages on his many blogs about them. Illegal hate is defined by Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act as, quote, A, The act is reasonably likely in all circumstances to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate another person or group of people. And, B, the act is done because of the race, colour, or national or ethnic origin of the other person or of some or all of the people in the group. Unquote. Now, that is intended to be limited to race or culture and does include, by insinuation, religion. Now, as we know, or at least those of us who pay attention know, there are calls by idiots who should know better for that part of the act to be repealed. I say absolutely not, because it's the closest thing we have to protection for the autistic community. It's not complete, of course, but it can be used, and I will leave that there. Believe me, I am pursuing something along those lines for not just the autistic community, but every member of the community that is regarded as disabled. But here's my point. I've been accused of having hate pages on my website. Now, I assume it's in reference to the autistic enemies list. Trolling is not hate speech. And besides, when one tells the truth, it's called honest trolling. There's no law against trolling in general anyway, unless it breaches that law I just quoted. And I have never done that in any of the articles on my website. Honest trolling is something that I consider appropriate. Inflammatory, yes, but there are times when I think it's needed, especially with the anti-vaxxers and indeed the Curebies and the autistic enemies. The world needs to know when someone is angry and has a right to be. As I said, that's what my autistic enemy pages are all about. My rightful anger at the people and groups that are named there.
And that's all I got to say about that.
You had to know that one was coming again, didn't you? like I said, oh blimey, I'm going to be even shorter this month. Finally, on Saturday morning, our time, the opening ceremony for the 2016 Olympic Games will be held. I wish all of our athletes all the best in Rio, and I hope there are no problems, not just for us, but for anyone else, particularly in the open water events. Look after yourselves and each other, and bring home as much gold as you can. Aussie, Aussie, Aussie! Oi, oi, oi! That doesn't work very well with one person, does it? that's it. That's it. That is all. There is no more. I'm Phil Glewis. Your time is up. Catch you next time.